If it's boring, they've got it. If it matters, we've got it. Kello, News Talk 1320, 107.9.
And welcome to Medical Line, a very special edition of Medical Line this morning with longtime Sioux Falls physician, Dr. Jerry Walton. Dr. Walton, how are you this morning?
Well, I'm great, Greg.
Well, and this is this is a very big day for you. You've hosted this show for 33 years, 13 years, the past 13 years here on Kello. August of 2000 is when we started your show here on Kello.
Wow.
And which has been a long time in and of itself. Yeah. And today is your last program.
This is it, Greg, and I appreciate your co-hosting this last program with me. That's an honor for me. Thank you.
Well, I feel the other way around. It was very much an honor for me to be able to sit in with you. I've obviously gotten to know you a little bit over the years. And as we do the show this morning, we'll do a little bit different show. With this being your last show, medicine obviously is something that's been very important. It's been your life, a big part of your life. Let's start back kind of at the beginning. Why did you make the decision to get into medicine?
You know, it's kind of interesting. I always envied these people that started out in grade school, knew what they wanted from then on. I had a roommate in college that he knew he wanted to be a doctor from the time he was in grade school. He went right through. He went straight A's through college, went to Presbyterian Medical School and graduated, took a straight internship at, he went to Columbia Medical School and took a straight internship at Presbyterian Hospital and went out into practice. I started college. I knew that I wanted to be in some service area. I wanted to be involved with people, not things. And so we had a religious leader that came from Isla Seminary the fall of my freshman year in college. And we had a religious week. And he gave a lot of lectures and actually did some personal counseling and vocational counseling, too. And I spent some time with him and talked with him. And we decided that the ministry was right for me. My dad was a minister. My grandfather was an itinerant preacher. He preached in tents from Texas to North Dakota. And it was kind of in the blood. And it looked like a real way to service people. And I felt convicted with my religion. So I pre-registered as a pre-thi student for 4 years of college. Well, as it turned out, what I decided, because I got my local preacher's license, I served Canastota one summer as a preacher and went out on deputation teams, and so we preached at various places around South Dakota. But I was finding that I didn't really feel the calling to pulpit ministry. I wanted more the one-on-one kind of counseling, so I thought, well, I'm going into some special faith. Maybe I'll become a prison chaplain or something of that nature where there's more personal kind of involvement and less of the pulpit. So I decided if I was going to do that, I really needed to know and understand medicines, what they use for depression and anxiety, and I wanted to be familiar with that if I was going to be the complete package. So, I got to go to med school to go into psychiatry. So I decided that that's what I was going to do the spring of my senior year in college. Well, I had 10 hours of biology. I was majoring in psychology, a minor in religion and philosophy, and speech and drama, and I had nothing that I needed for med school. So I had to back up. Well, in the meantime, this girl that I fell in love with the first time I saw her was a junior in high school when I was a freshman in college. And so she finished up high school, and she came to Dakota Wesleyan, where I was, and we talked a lot, did a lot of planning, and so we really planned to get married when I graduated, and she would just have completed 2 years, so she sped up her education so that she could graduate in 3 years. And not only did she do that, but she was a cheerleader, she was homecoming queen, she was in every drama they had, she was a soloist with the choir, she was a runner-up to Miss South Dakota, and she received the highest honor Dakota Wesleyan had to offer, which was Miss Wesleyan, was chosen by faculty and students, and she graduated summa cum laude. So, I mean, she was the complete package. She was beautiful. She was sexy. She was pert, just, I mean, smart. I mean, it just was a, it was a match made in heaven as far as I was concerned. So, at any rate, she finished up in 3 years, and I went back and took another year. So, I completed 5 years there, starting on my pre-med, then switched to Augie because she got a job teaching at Whittier Junior High School. And I took a semester there, and during that semester, I got drafted. I also got my acceptance to med school and got drafted. And so I went to the draft board, and I said, hey, I'm glad to serve my country. Let me finish my education. I'm married. I'm in school. I've got my acceptance to medical school. And I said, no, we take them as their name comes up. So I got drafted. I had to go after the semester and went to Fort Carson and did my basic and got assigned to a research institute in Chicago. And so Pat and I lived in Chicago, and we lived in an area, South Chicago, Southside Chicago. And my first clue that we were in a troubled area was when I tried to get my car insurance switched over to Chicago. They said, no, we won't insure you. And I said, well, I know it's going to be increased. No, we won't even insure you in that area. Wow. So I had to get some liability insurance, and it was like cost me a fortune to get that. And so we lived in a 1.5-room unit with a Murphy bed. And there were, just to give you an idea of the area, there were 5 murders within a radius of 12 blocks during the time that we were there. So we didn't spend many evenings outside of our 1.5-room units. We got real familiar with each other, you know. So at any rate, I had to complete another course. And so I enrolled at Roosevelt University, which is downtown Chicago, in quantitative analysis, which was one of the courses I had to have for pre-med. So I had to take a night course. So I never took more than I needed for fare to ride the L. I had to ride the L, the elevated downtown, and then 10 classes for about 3 hours. And I get out about 10 or 10:30, and then I get back on the L and go back down south Chicago. And I always wore tennis shoes, loose clothes, and not much else. And I never let anybody get within a half a block of me. I ran down the street. I didn't even take the sidewalks. And then when I got to our apartment, I would just look to see if there was anybody around, have the key in my hand so that I could run in, get through the locked door, and get it closed before anybody would have a chance to come in. So that was kind of Chicago living. And we did research on field rations and space feeding was what I was involved with in that. And then when I was getting out of the service, well, they had told me when I got out just to let them know at med school. And so I did. I said, I'm coming, and I want to be in the fall class. And they wrote back and said, you got to reapply.
Oh.
And I thought, oh, maybe I'm going to lose my career over this. So I was really, you know, disappointed. So I reapplied, and I did get accepted, and I still had some courses to complete. So I went back to Augie, took another semester, took a summer school session, and then started med school in the fall. And so I started at Vermilion. They just had a 2-year school at that time. And I can tell you, I almost quit. The first year, I had made a commitment to myself. I said, Jerry, you will not quit med school. The only way you will leave is if they throw you out or fail you out or whatever it takes. So at any rate, towards the end of our freshman year, we had a physical diagnosis class, and we had to do a physical at the end of the year, and we did them at Yankton Hospital, and they had an open ward for women. Most of them were older women and had dementia of some type. And so we had some of our lectures in a classroom just outside this ward, this open ward. And when we were in there, we'd hear strange sounds coming from the ward, you know. And there was one that every time we had a class, we'd hear it. She'd go, na 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 Nina, Nina, Nina. And it would be really loud, you know. And so we're all looking at each other thinking, wow, hope I don't get her.
Right.
So the day comes, we're assigned to do a physical, and I go over to my patient, the cubicle. They just had half walls. If you sat up, you could see everybody in the room. If you laid down, nobody could see you. So she's laying there, and I told her who I was, that I need to do a physical exam, and that I'd like to look into her ears. So I kind of reached over with my otoscope and kind of almost touched her ear. She started in, Nina, 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 you know, and I kind of backed off, and then I said, well, look in the other ear. Same thing happened. And then she sat up and was screaming. And so I said, when she kind of quieted down, I said, well, I need to listen to your lungs. I'll just listen in back here. So I got my stethoscope on her chest, and she let out with these loud sounds about blew my ears off, you know, and then she laid back down. So I said, well, I'll listen to your heart, you know, and I couldn't even get my stethoscope on her, and she was screaming again. So I finally went over to the doctor in charge. I said, I can't do a physical on her. He said, oh, you're having a problem? I said, yes. So he comes over and he kind of looks at her, and she's laying there just quietly, and he kind of looks at me strange. And then he kind of reached his hand out and just barely touched her, and she started in. He says, oh, I see. So,
that's what it took. Huh?
That's what it took. So he assigned me to a new patient, and our time was just about up then, so I had to do a very cursory kind of physical exam and closed the book on that. And as I was taking the bus back to Vermilion from Yankton with the crew, I was thinking, do I really want to do this? I don't know.
Right, so, talk about that. I mean, because that's got to be something as a physician that you see people suffering. And, mm-hmm. and if you see people maybe who are mentally ill, it's got to be very difficult. How do you not internalize some of that?
Well, you do. You know, you can't get away from that. And if you care about people and if you get involved with them, you can't help but internalize it and feel it. And I told myself if I ever got away from that where I didn't feel that way, I better get out of medicine. But there are those that build a wall around themselves and they just refuse to become involved with the emotions of what they're doing. And that's how some doctors protect themselves. And when you're dealing with it constantly, like in oncology and people are dying of cancer, you have to have a certain valve there that you can kind of shut off. But I just said, hey, I'm not shutting it off. This is going to, I'm going to relate to them and I'm going to share with them and I'm going to feel what they're feeling.
So after this experience with this woman, then how did you come to grips with that and why did you change your mind, stay in medicine?
Well, because I said I wasn't going to quit. I mean, you had to have that determination, you know, and I just said, they're going to have to throw me out of here. I'm staying, you know. And so I got into my sophomore year, and towards the end of the year, we had these finals, and boy, they piled it on. We had neuroanatomy, we had bacteriology, we had clinical pathology, and all of these came at 1 week. So I had like 5 exams, and they were all big exams. You didn't dare fail any of them. So I pretty much was up all night. I would do, when I get through one test, I'd just start on the next, and I'd study till I had to go to the test, and I'd study till I had the next test. So I don't know if I had more than, you know, 2 or 3 hours sleep on through Thursday from the beginning of the week. And so I'm studying in the library. I had one more test, clinical pathology, Friday morning, and there were other people studying too. I couldn't stay awake. I mean, I was just drifting off, and I thought, oh, this is bad. I'm just not going to get through this. And one of the guys came over, and he says, you look pretty sleepy. I said, I am. I can't stay awake. He said, do you want a Dexedrine? And I'd never taken anything before, and I thought, I've got nothing to lose. I'm gone right now. So I said, sure, I'll take one. So I took a Dexedrine, the stimulant, and, man, in a few minutes, I was perking up. I mean, I was getting hot. I could... Everything was interesting to me. I just got so involved, but it got to be so much. I had to go outside and run around the block. And then I'd come back, and I'd study for about 45 minutes. I'd go out and run around the block and come back.
Wow.
So this thing lasted clear into the exam we had on Friday morning. So I'm taking my clinical path course, and it was so interesting. Not only was the content of the test interesting, but the way they worded the questions and the selections they had for possible answers. I mean, I just got enthralled with all of this, you know. So I didn't even finish the test. But I think what I did do was right, because I did pass.
You're right.
But I was so enthralled with all of this, I thought, I'm going to be a clinical pathologist. And so I went up and talked to the instructor afterwards. We must have spent 20 or 30 minutes talking. You know, who do I talk to? Who do I see about getting into this specialty, et cetera, et cetera? I went home, and about the time I hit the door, I just died. I think I slept for about 10 or 12 hours. That was the end of my career in clinical pathology.
Your interest wore off with the stimulant?
It did. Yeah. It really wore off, yeah.
So and we visited with you a few weeks ago. You know, you were at Parkland Hospital during the JFK assassination, actually were there. As you look back on your career in medicine, obviously that's one of the things that must stick out in your mind. What other memories do you have most of your, you know, of a career in medicine?
You know, there are certain things that do stick out, but there are a lot, Greg. And, you know, we had to transfer from the University of South Dakota somewhere else because we just had a two-year school at that time. And I wanted to go where it was warm. So we went to Dallas. And interestingly enough, it's a county hospital, and it's a teaching hospital. And a lot of the people, the patients there are the inner city welfare people. A lot of blacks, a lot of other nationalities, too, that are just living kind of almost in the gutter there. And that's what Parkland is. I mean, it's a great teaching hospital because you see absolutely everything, every kind of disease and advanced disease and so forth from a learning standpoint. But, you know, you feel sorry for these people. Well, I can remember one incident I had early on. I hadn't worked around black people much. Certainly didn't have any prejudice. I was very interested in their culture. But I was asked to draw some blood on a gentleman. I went up to it. He was in a ward. And he was a black man with gray hair and kind of distinguished looking, like a George Washington Carver or something, you know. And so I went up to him and I said, I need to draw some blood. And I could tell from his responses, I mean, there wasn't a whole lot upstairs. I mean, the guy had had a really poor life and probably booze and so forth. And so I said, let me see your arm. Well, I looked at his arms. He'd been in the hospital a long time. He had scars from drawing bloods. I mean, and his veins were like cords in the backs of his hands. So I thought, gee, there's no place there I can even draw blood. And in those days, the needles were re-sterilized. They didn't have these throwaway needles. They were all re-sterilized. So you can imagine what those tips were like. They were curled like on a sled, you know?
Sure.
They were all curled. So, well, you stuck a person. I mean, you just, you had to really jab to get it in there, the poor patient.
Yeah.
So I looked at him and I thought, there's no way I'm getting in his arms. I better do a femoral vein tap. Now, the femoral vein runs down in the groin area and down the leg, right next to the femoral artery. So you you feel for the pulse of the femoral artery, and then you just put the needle in right next to it to get into the femoral vein. So kind of pull his jams down, and I get this alcohol sponge, and I'm rubbing him in the groin area. And as I'm doing this, his eyes are just getting bigger and whiter by the minute, you know. And then I pull up this syringe with a long needle on it, you know, and I'm kind of over him like this. He raised his head up, and he says, "Dane, nobody never stuck nothing in my spinous." And so I had to convince him that that wasn't his spine and that I was just going to get some blood, which I finally did get. But there were a lot of examples like that. One of the things that I remember so dramatically, because it really came home to me how you don't become a doctor overnight. It's something, you know, and a lot of people probably don't think about this, but to go into a room where somebody has undressed, they're in some flimsy gown and naked underneath, you don't know them, first time you've seen them, and you're asking a personal question like, how often do you have intercourse? Does your bladder leak? Are you constipated? And this is a stranger, you know. And then you do a physical exam, you actually touch them, somebody that you've never seen before. You don't just develop that overnight. Just because you put a white coat on and have a stethoscope, it's not there. You're like the man off the street. So it's something that you have to acquire. Well, I was assigned to Baylor Hospital with a surgeon there, and I was asked to do a pre-surgical physical. And so this was late afternoon, and I went over to this area of the hospital. I'd never been in that area before, and suddenly it's carpeted, and they've got these soft lights in the hall, and obviously where the rich go. And I got to the door, and I knocked, and I heard this voice. This woman says, "Come in." So I opened the door, and it's like walking into a hotel room. You know, there's twin bedside tables, fancy lamps. The bed is not a hospital bed. She's got a fancy phone, and she says, "Oh, my doctor's here. I have to go now." So she hung up the phone. She's laying there, dark brunette, 33 years old, beautiful woman in a red negligee. And suddenly my knees are weak. I am out of my element. I
mean,
when they've got that southern exposure gown on and everything is sterile white, you know, and you got IVs running and all of this kind of stuff, I could, you know, kind of think I'm a doctor then, but not under these circumstances. So I walked in, I introduced myself. I said, I'm Dr. Walton. I'm here to do your pre-surgical physical. And she said, okay. So I said, I'll take a look in your ears. And I looked in her ears, checked her throat, felt her thyroid gland. I said, I need to listen to your lungs and heart. She said, okay. And she kind of pulled the covers down and just kind of stuck out her chest. So I'm thinking, I have to unbutton this. And I, you know what it's like to have 10 thumbs?
Yeah.
They were little tiny buttons, little tiny button holes. And here I am fumbling, trying to unbutton this red negligee. And I finally get it unbuttoned, you know. So I take my stethoscope and I put it over her heart on her chest. And I could hear this pounding, just pounding, pounding, pounding. I thought, she has got a heart problem. And then I realized I still had it hanging around my neck. So, I mean, I'm losing my cool. So I try to kind of slide it up in one ear and then the other. And still my heart was competing with hers on this. So I listened to her heart, listened to her lungs, checked her abdomen where she was going to have a gallbladder, and did the reflex. I checked her legs and for varicosities and stuff and put everything back in my little bag. And I said, well, we'll see you in the morning. She says, okay, doctor, thank you. I walked out the door, shut it, and nearly collapsed in the hall, you know. So anyway, sequel to this is that, like, she did fine in surgery, and about 2 or 3 days later, and she's recovering well, and she's back in her red negligee, and I make rounds with the doctor. So we walk in, and he goes up to the foot of the bed, and he's asking her questions, and here's this monster of a man standing next to her bed, like 270, 6'5", plays for the Dallas Cowboys. This is her husband. You know, so he's standing there, and she's kind of holding his hand, and the doctor's asking her questions, and I just kind of faded back, you know, off his shoulder and back and a little bit into the corner. Finally, she turns to her husband. She says, honey, I want you to meet Dr. Walton. He's the coolest doctor I've ever met. I thought, lady, if you only knew.
Yeah.
But the point I want to make is that you just don't become a doctor by putting on a white coat and
right.
a stethoscope. I would say that I did not feel like I really had something to contribute till probably the middle year of my internship. And then when I went into a patient, I knew I had something to offer. If I was going to take a personal history and do a personal physical exam, I knew that I could give them something back in return instead of just saying, thank you for letting me do this.
Well, there is something about that confidence, finding that confidence.
Yeah.
And you're confident in your own abilities and you know what you can do. And that gives a person, I think, tremendous strength.
Yeah, it does. It makes you become a doctor, you know. Then you start to be a doctor because then you're thinking about the things that you can do and the diagnosis and the differential and all of this thing instead of just worrying about whether you're offending them by talking to them or examining them.
Oh, those are great stories. It is 28 minutes past 10. You're listening to Medical Line with longtime Sioux Falls physician Dr. Jerry Walton. We'll go ahead. We'll take a break here. We got a natural break here. We'll go ahead and break, get to the Fox Business Report. More with Dr. Walton and our final edition of Medical Line coming up. Good morning and welcome to Medical Line here on News Talk 1320. KELO, AM 1320, 107.9. This is Dr. Jerry Walton's final Medical Line show after 13 years here on KELO, kind of a special program this morning. And Dr. Walton, your daughters are here.
They are. Three of our five daughters are here and in the studio and kind of monitoring me to make sure I told the line. And we've got one of the daughters.
Somebody needs to do it.
Well, yeah, yeah. I've had plenty of help.
We've chastised you so many times. Yeah, we've chastised you so many times over the years. Tough to keep
right.
you in line here.
Right.
But Jerry's daughter, Sharla, who's known to many, wanted to have a few words. Sharla, good morning.
Hi, good morning, Greg. Dad, this is just such a momentous occasion, and we're just so grateful as your family to be a part of it and to have spent the last 33 years, listening in whenever we could at every chance, and having the opportunity for the world to see what we knew in you. Of course, you're a good father to us and a wonderful husband to our mother, but you had something just really extra special that you brought to your medical practice. And I knew that from hearing from friends. Oh, I go to your dad. I love him. You know, he's the best and how lucky you are. And, you know, when you're a young child, you don't necessarily feel that. You kind of go, oh, he's my dad, you know. But I knew from the stories I heard the kind of care that you gave and seeing you and having you take care of my children as they grew up, getting to see firsthand. But I really feel you answered, in giving your story earlier, you really answered the calling, a higher calling from God. He called you to ministry, and you did just that through your medical practice. And the amount of lives you've touched and really impacted over the years is truly amazing, and I think is really unknown how many lives you've touched, and through them, how many more lives have been touched. And to feel that we're your family is just an amazing and kind of elevating experience. And I promised not to take too long, but I just, to watch you here in the studio, and I've been in the studio years ago doing a show, and I know what it takes, and to be able to answer the callers and truly care. You talked about how that difficulty in learning how to, it's not just because you put on the white gown, but it's not just because you sit behind a microphone either. You have to be able to reach out to people in a way that most cannot, to be able to truly hear what they're asking and provide an answer that's meaningful to them. And it's just such a gift that you have. And just on behalf of the family and the listeners, I just want to say a gigantic thank you, a debt of gratitude that you came on the scene when there was nothing like this. There wasn't the medical shows on TV, the call-in shows. This wasn't happening. People weren't able to call in and ask an expert about something, and especially not medicine. And for you to have that vision and foresight and then do it in such a way that it lasted for 33 years is just, you know, unfathomable.
Well, and thank you, honey.
We love you so much.
Well, thank you.
We're so, so proud of you.
Thanks, honey. And I've got two other daughters here in the studio, and I'm just grateful to have. And Santa Claus has heard you, I'm sure.
That was my point. Good.
Right. We're going to go to the phone here quickly, too. We've got Shelly, who's been waiting on the line, who's a PA. Good morning, Shelly.
Hi. Hi, honey. Dad.
Hi, honey.
Hi, sisters. I'm not sure which ones are there. So.
Hey, hi, Shelly. Steph, Shauna, and Charla.
Okay, that's kind of what I thought. Well, I'm going to make mine brief, too, but I just wanted to call in and say a few things, and I'm not quite as eloquent as Charla is, so I'm probably going to read mine. But I've been thinking about what I wanted to say today, and I know you have a lot that you want to share with listeners today, so like I say, I'll try to make this brief. Not only are you knowledgeable and respected, and a respected physician, but you're an awesome and much loved father, husband, and grandfather. And Charla already said that. I'm really sorry I couldn't be there with you today in body, but you know that I am certainly there with you in spirit.
I know that, Charla.
Being a medical provider as well, I want to thank you for the wealth of health knowledge and peace of mind that you have offered to patients over the years. With the push to see patients more rapidly, sometimes education, I think, is one of the things that we are limited as to what we can share with people. And so we kind of just choose those critical items that they have to know, but there's other things that they want to know or that they really need to hear too. And I think you've offered that education with your program. And I just wanted to say you amaze me with your plethora of knowledge on so many topics. I know, being a medical provider myself, there is just so much to know, and you just, I don't know how you know what you know, but it's amazing. And then you can just pull it off the top of your head, and I think that's awesome.
Thank you very much.
I know your program will be missed, Dad. And most importantly, I can't say enough how much I respect you. I love you so much.
Thanks, Shelley. Right back at you, too,
Shelley, honey. Thanks for your call. It is 10:38 here at Kello, News Talk 1320, 107.9. Dr. Jerry Walton and his final medical line program this morning. And just on a personal note, a lot of people may not, you know, been talking about medicine and what you've given in terms of medicine. You've been a real community leader, Jerry. I mean, your service to the community goes beyond just medicine. And a lot of people know this. Certainly people who know you are well aware of this. You know, you've been sort of on the board of directors of the Chamber of Commerce. You were, you know, have head up the, in the past, the United Way Drive, served as the chair for United Way, among a variety of other things that you've done. You've, as Charlotte was talking about, that call to minister, your faith, obviously, that's been important to you, and I think it's been obvious in the things you've done, in your service not only in, as I said, in medicine, but to the community as a whole. You know, as we talked years ago, as obesity was becoming a growing epidemic,
right.
You know, you started the Growing Healthy Initiative here in Sioux Falls locally. So obviously, you more than just have felt these things, you've put them into practice in your life.
Well, thank you. I can't help but feel my life has been guided and directed, and I kind of got to where I am, kind of a roundabout way from the ministry to psychiatry to not hitting that off with psychiatry at all and going into medicine and family medicine, and it was my niche. I had agreed to go to Martin, South Dakota, to practice with my old roommate who was out there in the public health service. And Martin is the county seat of Bennett County, but completely surrounded by Rosebud and Pine Ridge Reservation. So it's Indian country.
You're talking about basically a poor section of the state out there.
Right. 1,200 population in Martin, South Dakota. And he kept calling me in my internship and saying, Jerry, you got to come out and help me. He said, I'm swamped out here and I need help. And I was thinking about a surgical residency, maybe neurosurgery or plastic and reconstructive surgery, something like that. I kind of like the innovative type of thing, like to work with my hands. And he said, well, we got the banana belt out here. He says, that comes down from the Black Hills, and it's milder climate out here in South Dakota and so forth. I said, well, I'll come out and look.
He was spinning the yarn,
wasn't
he?
Oh, he was spinning it, yeah. So the day Pat and I drove out there, it was so gusty and windy, about blew us off the road. I got there, and I was afraid to open my door for fear it would tear it off. I mean, the trees were leaning, and so I rolled down my window, and he came running out of the house and said, hi, welcome. And I said, banana belt fooey. And without missing a stroke, he said, well, we got to have some way to get the bananas off the trees. So at any rate, I came back to South Dakota from Southwestern because I wanted to do, that's where I wanted to practice, was in South Dakota, and took a rotating internship at Sioux Valley Hospital. Had some experiences there. I remember they always had like a Dr. Hart. If there was an emergency at one of the rooms, code blue it became after a while. But whenever we heard this, well, all of the house staff would converge. The nurses would come and the technicians would come and they'd bring the defibrillator and we'd all converge on this room. So we got this call, this code blue, and we ran to this room and this guy was unconscious. His heart was in fibrillation. We got him hooked up so we could see what rhythm there wasn't. And his blood pressure had dropped. And so we stimulated him. We did a defibrillation and put the paddles on him and got some IV medicines in him, and he started to come around. And so everybody's intent over this bed. We're all kind of leaning over the bed. And we had a female intern on our staff at that time, and she was right close to him. And so he kind of opened his eyes and looked up, and so she leaned over and she says, how do you feel? He said, with my hands. And, you know, everybody kind of jumps back and thinking, what is this? and then we had the sound on so we could see his tracing, and we could hear beep, 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 real regular. And then it started going beep, 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 beep. And he said, somebody changed the station. And he went out again, and he was unconscious. And we defibrillated him again and kind of brought him back. And finally, I mean, everybody's just leaning over this bed with this guy. And he kind of opens his eyes, and he looks around. He says, got a pretty good turnout, didn't we? I thought, this can't be. This just isn't happening. You know, so we got him transferred to intensive care, and that was it.
You got to appreciate somebody who can keep their sense of humor through something like that.
Oh, yeah. But how could he have it? Yeah, I don't
really know.
I mean, that's
really,
life and death matter.
Absolutely.
Say we got a pretty good turnout. So at any rate, I finished my year there, went to Martin, and finally did go out there. And I told my partner, I said, Ted, I will be here 4 years, and I'm going back to a residency. I'll decide what I want to go to. Interestingly enough, the 4 years ended. He went back to residency, and I stayed. I had found my niche, and it was taking care of families and becoming involved in their affairs and their medical needs. And it just was, for me, it was a perfect fit. Ted went on back to a cardiovascular residency, and he opened up the open heart program down in Sioux City, Iowa. He was the one to start it down there. And so I stayed 2 more years on by myself, and then I was missing all the kids' birthdays. It was 24/7 by myself. And
talk about that, maybe the toll on your family and maybe the sacrifices that all of you made.
Well, it got heavy. I always said my family came first. But what do you do when they call you and say, you got a baby up here that's about ready to come out, or somebody just came in with a heart attack, or they're bleeding to death? They may be your primary concern, but they are secondary under those circumstances. And that just kept happening and happening. And I came home one night, and I had just missed one of the girls' birthdays, and the celebration was over, and I got there, and Pat, who was just an angel, and she never was critical, never complained. She'd always keep supper and wait till I got home. If it was 8 o'clock, we always ate together, and she was just so good about that. And she said to me, Jerry, she said, you can't even be at the birthday parties of your kids. You don't remember their birth dates. Said, we have no life together. And she said, something's got to give. She didn't say, I'm leaving you. She didn't say anything else. She said, Jerry, something's got to give. And when she said that, I knew something had to give. And it had been, really tough on the whole family because I was losing contact with them.
So what did you do at that point?
Well, I was trying to get somebody to come in and get a partner. I couldn't. Every place I called at that time, they were giving me a counteroffer to go there. And so I finally just said, we got to leave. And so we picked Sioux Falls to come back to. I'd trained there and knew some doctors, and they had invited me into their practice. And so we pulled up stakes and left and came back to Sioux Falls.
So when did
practice.
You arrive in Sioux Falls? When would this have been?
This would have been July of 1971. And, of course, they had me listed to be on call for that 4th of July in the practice. You know, I'm just getting
sure.
back,
yeah.
you know.
Yeah, welcome.
The young
Here you
guy.
Go, yeah.
So I said, you know what? I'm really sorry, but I can't come until the 5th. I thought, you know, I've been 24/7 for, all of this time. I'm not going to go there and take a holiday call right away. So I didn't. But I wanted to just mention a couple things because Martin was quite an experience for me. I mean, I learned to do everything there. I did exchange transfusions on a newborn. I did amniocentesis. I did orthopedic problems, intermedullary rods, grafting from the pelvis on a bone, hysterectomies, C-sections, splenectomies, tonsillectomies, amputation.
I mean, I've got to imagine for
flaps.
A guy who wanted to practice medicine, you would have been rolling in it.
Oh, man. I mean, I had... And I'd say, you need to go to Rapid City. Well, you know, we need to get you. Nope, Doc, I'm staying here. I'm not leaving home. You take care of me. So, I mean, I did stuff that I look back at some of the op notes and did I do that? I mean, it's just really.
It's impressive.
But I had a couple of instances I had a lot of them while I was in Martin, but a couple that I might just mention briefly. One is that on New Year's Eve, we were celebrating New Year's Eve with some friends. And I got this call. I had to go down to the morgue. So I went down there, and the mortician said, they brought this guy in, this body, and he said, you know, it probably will go to court. You might have to testify. You better take a look. Well, he was a young Native American in his early 20s, shot in the head. So I said, well, what is the story on this? And he said, well, he and his buddy decided they were going to celebrate New Year's Eve. And so they went in and got a big jug of wine. And one of them had his sister with him, and the other one had an uncle and a nephew. And they, so they got in their car, and they drove out on a county road right in the middle of an intersection. It was a bright, moonlit night, and it was fresh snow, so the only tracks were theirs. And they parked it right in the middle of this intersection, got the wine out, and started drinking. And the more they drank, the more they got to arguing. And these two guys started fighting. They were friends. And the sister of one went to the trunk and got a tire iron and hit him over the head. And then her brother got the rifle out and shot him. So the uncle and the nephew take off over the hill, and the brother and sister just sit down, and they're drinking wine. And there's a corpus delicti in the middle of the road, and all the snow tracks and the rifle and the tire iron is all there. Well, a rancher heard the sound, called the sheriff. Sheriff comes out. Here they are just sitting there drinking. So, you know, he arrests the guy. And, of course, they came out and measured to see if it should be on Indian land or if it's on county land. Well, it was on county land, so they went to state court. And interestingly enough, Greg, he gets off scot-free. With all of that information there, the uncle would not testify, the nephew would not testify, the sister would not testify. They had no witness, and it was all circumstantial evidence, and none of the Native Americans would testify against him. And so he gets off scot-free. Well, about a week or 10 days later, he ends up in the emergency room, and it was a hit and run. And so he had all kinds of injuries. And so, you know, it wasn't life-threatening. And so he was there a couple of days, I said, what happened? He says, well, they're going to get me. He says, they'll get me. And I said, what are you going to do? I'm going down to Nebraska. I've got friends and family down there. And so he did, and then I read in the paper, like a couple weeks later, he had been run over, hit and run. So it was their justice. So, I mean, that was kind of interesting.
Wow. We're going to go back to the phones here for just a moment because we've got a voice that I know you will, want to put your headphones on, that you will recognize. Shannon Nordstrom is on the line. Good morning, Shannon. How you doing?
Hey, very good, guys.
Hi, Shannon.
I just wanted to call in and congratulate you on your long run of, was it 33 years on the air?
Yeah, yeah.
What a long run, and you set the standard for talk radio shows in Sioux Falls for all those years, and we just want to wish you the best. I'm sure you're going to be doing plenty of other things with the extra time, but it's been a joy to hear you on the air and be part of the family as we've done this together.
Well, thank you for that. That's a compliment coming from you because you guys run such a good show.
Well, thank you very much. And so now, I think if you retire, now we can take the crown of the longest-running talk show in Sioux Falls.
All right. All right. Good
you
for
want,
you.
Yeah, you want another hour on Kello? Is that what you're after, Shannon?
No, my dad came in, and he had been listening in the vehicle, and I was busier with some meetings, and he said, hey, turn on the radio, and I didn't realize that you were coming to a point where you're going to say enough of this, and use that time for other things. And I just wanted to congratulate you because, like I said, it's been quite a run, and you've done a lot of good for the community, and the same thing we try to do in educating people and getting them so they can make good decisions. So congratulations.
Thanks, so much. Thanks, Shannon. I appreciate it.
Let's talk about the radio show, Jerry. By the way, it is 10:52 here at Kello. You're listening to Medical Line with longtime Sioux Falls physician Dr. Jerry Walton. This is Dr. Walton's final program this morning. In the time we have left, because I do want to make sure we cover this, how did Medical Line come to be?
Well, you know, interestingly enough, I don't know if you ever knew Daryl Stitt.
I did, actually.
Did you know Daryl?
Mm-hmm.
Daryl and I went to the same church together, and we sang in the choir together. And so we would oftentimes be sitting next to each other. And one time, kind of between breaks, he said, Jerry, would you ever be interested in doing like a talk show, maybe a call-in medical show? And I said, you know, I hadn't thought about it, but, you know, it's so difficult when you just have one-on-one in the office that you go over that same thing time and time again with each patient, you know. And I said, it would be, maybe there'd be a reason to do that where you could reach a lot of people at the same time. So I said, yeah, let's give it a try. So we just kind of did it on a trial basis, and it seemed pretty successful. And so I just started doing it. So Daryl was kind of the first. Carrie Wentzel was one of my co-hosts.
I know Carrie well.
For a period of time.
Oh, yeah.
And you know Steve Thompson.
Oh, yes.
And, you know, and then, of course, Jeff Gould and Bob Leskowski.
Right.
And yourself, Greg Belfridge and Norm Anderson have right. all been kind of co-hosts on the show. So it's been kind of a long history.
Did you ever, obviously, I can't imagine you ever thought you'd be doing it 33 years later.
No. No, I didn't. Never thought
about
that.
What kept you going? Why have you kept doing the show? Why did you, because I know how committed you are to the show, but listeners may not know.
I think it was because I saw an avenue of hopefully telling people what a doctor is. I wanted to portray an image for people out there that, you know, doctors are caring, that they are knowledgeable in what they're doing. And it was also a way to reach questions. A lot of people will come in the office, and if a doctor looks at their watch, you know, it's like, oh, he's too busy. I'm not going to ask him that question. Or they just can't remember questions when when right. he comes in hurried into the room and does an exam and kind of takes over. So I thought, well, this is a way in which they can just call in with any questions they have, whether it's about themselves or family or just stuff that they're reading in the paper. So I felt that it was an avenue that probably needed to be reached.
And sometimes I think as a patient, it's maybe a little easier, you know, if I'm looking you in the face to ask you a question that maybe I'm a little bit nervous about, I'm scared, it might right. be a little bit easier to pick up a phone and I'm not looking you in the face, you know, yeah. as I'm some deeply personal, you know, problem that I might be having.
Right, exactly. And so that we wanted to reach those people that just were a little bit afraid to either go in and see the doctor or should I see a doctor. Some were kind of bashful about, you know, if I even need to see a doctor. So it provided them with an opportunity to ask, do I need to see a doctor for this? Is this important? Is it cancer or is it just something that'll go away in 2 months or what?
Now, as you talked about being a family physician and how that really was your calling, we should note you were selected as South Dakota's Family Physician of the Year here a few years ago.
You remember that?
That had to be a nice honor for you.
It was a very nice honor, and actually I finished in the final 10 nationally that year. It was then went to the nationals. So I felt really honored to be considered under those circumstances.
Absolutely. Now, you were talking about Dakota Wesleyan earlier.
Yeah.
My understanding is you talked about all these things that your wife was doing.
Yeah.
My understanding is you were doing a lot of that stuff too, right?
Well, it was one of the reasons I wanted to go to a small Christian school was because I loved football, but I didn't want to eat and breathe and sleep it.
Sure.
I wanted to play it, but I wanted to be involved. So I got involved. I was in a number of dramas, and I was in chorus and did some solo work. And
I would love to see you on stage. That would be a hoot.
It was fun.
Because I love it, too.
And I know you do. Yeah. It's one thing. And I love to see you on stage.
You're a big patron of it. You remain a patron of theater. Absolutely.
I love to see you on stage, Greg. So, yeah. And I did. I reached some fame with football. I was inducted in the South Dakota Intercollegiate Hall of Fame.
Because I think you're being modest, because from some of what I heard, that maybe you could have pursued that a little bit more.
Well, I did have a letter from the Rams. I had an invitation to try out, and I led the nation in yards per carry in small colleges and universities from a fullback position. And they had one all-star team. I don't remember if you remember the newspaper that came out. Was it not Dakota Sports? But it came out just 1 year, I think, they had. And they named an all-college team, all-star team. And one of the guys that went on to play professionally from state was on it. And I got on it my freshman year in college. And so I felt, you know, really privileged to have that. But I wanted more than just the football.
It is 10:57. 10:50. We got about 2 minutes here.
Have we? Okay.
So we're. I want to give it to you. I mean, is in the final minutes here, for you to share your thoughts.
Okay. Well, you know, I think what I do want to say is that I really appreciated my sponsors. We've kind of cut the sponsors off this time just so that we could have a little more time. But my first original sponsor, Medical Line, was North Central Heart. And I really appreciate their having confidence in me to sponsor me to begin with. And then Vera McKinnon and Sioux Valley Hospital, with Sioux Valley at the time, co-sponsored. The two hospitals sponsored this program for a period of time. And then it became Sanford and Sanford Health Plan, where I was medical director for 5 years after I retired from practice. They've been so supportive, and I have appreciated their support. And Lewis Drug, which is... has been supportive ever since. There was never any question. They supported me all the way, and it's very community-minded. And if you want a community-minded local store, go to Lewis Drug. We shop there all the time simply because they're so involved in community, all the things they've done. So I thank all of my sponsors, and I thank Kello AM and all of the staff, Greg and all of his staff and the people that have worked here. They've been just great to work with. So I really am thankful for that. And my family has been so supportive. Five daughters and my wife have been just great in supporting this whole process. Finally, I want to tell our listeners that how much I deeply appreciate your listening to Medical Line, being a part of it. Your calls have meant a lot to me. And I just want to wish each and every one of you good health. Take care of your bodies. You only get one. And so take care of it and enjoy this blessed season and happiness throughout the coming years.
Merry Christmas and God bless Dr. Jerry Walton.
Thank you.
Kello News Talk 1320 KELO Sioux Falls, FM 107.9 KELQ Flandreau Sioux Falls, and online at Kello.com.